This is the Utik Tatatari 8-Bit Podcast.
Hello, my name is Randy Kindig, and I want to welcome you to this interview-only edition of Antic, the Atari 8-Bit Podcast. This interview is with longtime friend of the show, Chris Olson. Chris is an Atari enthusiast from a very early age, as he discusses in this interview. His father taught in the computer camps that Atari used to run in the 80s. Chris is known as CGO Apps in the forums. I hope you enjoyed this interview with a general Atari 8-Bit fan. Okay, well, I'm here with Chris Olson, Atari aficionado, and somebody who's been a longtime friend of the show. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you, sir?
Pretty good.
Great.
So, I wanted to find out a little bit more about you for the audience here. Where do you live? What do you do for a living?
Sure thing. I live in the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois. Day job is an airline pilot, which I really enjoy. I do a little bit of iOS development, kind of on the side, and definitely enjoy computers, Atari computers, but have had some experience with several different flavors, you know, Atari, Apple, now Macintosh, and IBM PC. So I've been able to cover quite a bit in that regard.
One of the things, Chris, when we were talking before, that I found very interesting is you're a fairly young guy. You're certainly younger than I am. So you've got some really early memories of using an Atari home computer. Is that right? How old were you when an Atari computer first came in your house?
Yeah, well, I'll be 36 here soon. So I was born in 78. And, you know, in going back and talking with my dad about this, the Atari 400 came into our household, would have been at the, in 1980. And I think it was pretty early on in 1980. And then, at some point, you know, I do have this memory of unboxing the computer, but it would have been, as I've kind of gone to revisit this, it would have been a little bit too early. But, we moved from, actually the city proper to the suburbs where my folks still are today, and the memory that I have is in the old place of having the 400 set up. And there's actually a photograph of me sitting on not a milk crate but something like that, and typing away or attempting to type away. So the it definitely was exposed to the computer at an early age, and that was primarily due to the fact that my dad was a professor and then later an administrator at one of the local universities, and that university had very strong ties to Atari. And I've actually since found out the reason for this was the provost of the university had a relative who was fairly high-ranking at Atari, and the last name is Moye, M-O-Y-E. I haven't been able to go back and research any type of Atari executives. I don't know truly how high up this person was, but the initial kind of batch of computers, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, was donated, and then that was the Atari and the university were kind of able to foster a relationship from there. So that is that's kind of how we were able to have the machine at home at first, and I just remember being fascinated. And it really was something that, it was an activity that my dad and I would really kind of do together. He had had worked with punch cards and, you know, various kind of different larger computers as he was getting his degrees at the University of Chicago. So he certainly, I think he knew Fortran and some of the other mainframe languages that he was actually able to take in undergrad. But this was something that we were able to kind of learn together, and that's, you know, one of my very, very fond memories of growing up is being able to kind of do this with him. And yeah, it was really something. I don't know that I've ever been able to quite replicate the kind of wonder and excitement of encountering a machine that that I had with, you know, the 400 and later the 800. It really is something that I just look back on very fondly.
Yeah, so you would have been really, really young when the Atari first came into the house.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So do you remember, so that was a 400, right, the first one?
Yes, yep, sure was.
So do you remember sitting down at the first time and wondering what this thing was and trying to type on it and what are your memories of it? Did you have any memories of it, I guess?
Yeah, no, I did. And to put the timeline together is, the first actual memory I have is typing into the memo pad, you know, with no cartridge in there, just the blue screen hooked up to a TV in kind of the back office with the apartment there had these old-fashioned radiators that would come on and make all this noise. So it would... and it would actually cause the scan lines in the TV to, you know, no one has a TV like this anymore, but the old TVs, if the train would go by or something like that, you get the lines that would kind of, I used to remember what they were called, but anyway, you get that kind of fuzzy things going, then when the radio would click on, you'd get that for just a little bit, which is kind of funny. Mm-hmm. But definitely remember, you know, the Atari computer memo pad and trying to type things in. I also remember, though, we had the... we had pretty much a stock 400, unmodified. It did have 16K, but it had the membrane keyboard and everything else was pretty standard. And it was very difficult to type on for both my dad and I.
Sure.
And that was challenging. And I can't remember if it was on Antic or one of the other podcasts, but I guess the design choice was to make it more kid friendly and kind of like a spill proof type thing. And I really didn't know that. I would not have thought of that. In fact, it almost seems like a detriment to, if you don't want, you know, your kids hacking away at the keys, this is great because, you know, good luck. Touch typing was just impossible. So.
Yeah. And it seems like it would be teaching the kids bad habits, right?
Right.
Because then they're used to trying to pound on the keys.
Sure.
So first time they encounter a real keyboard, that could be a problem. Yeah, that's a good point.
But as far as actually running software, I'm pretty sure it came with Star Raiders. If it didn't, we were able to borrow it or were able to go out and get it. I think it might have just been sitting around the university. But that's the first thing I actually remember, you know, kind of running. And that would have been a lot later. And having gone back and tried to play Star Raiders, I mean, that is a rather punishing game. I used to think I was pretty good at games, and once it got to the kind of first person shooter thing, it's kind of where it left me all behind. I said I missed that whole thing by a couple of years, and maybe the first couple that came out I was okay at, but once it started to go into the kind of Quake era, it just kind of passed me by. But Star Raiders definitely lowered my ego a little bit. I went back to try to play it, and I went, man, this is pretty tough. So certainly the animation is something that really, really stood out, how fluid it was, and the sound. I mean, that, reflecting on getting everything into, you know, 8,192 bytes, I still don't know how they did it. It's just amazing, but it really set the bar high. I saw the kind of fluid Starfield animation and the kind of fine scrolling in the map screen and all this stuff, and I just kind of at that young age thought, well, this is how other games or other programs should be. And whether it was on other platforms as I got a little bit older, or even other kind of games or programs on the Atari, it just wasn't the case. So that I didn't appreciate at the time, but certainly at some point I realized how kind of special that was and how it was just a really great kind of sales point for the machine. I mean, that, boy, you walk into a store, and I think that was common. If it wasn't the dealer demo, it was Star Raiders playing. Mm-hmm. And, how would you not want to say, wow, this is, you know, this really looks like you're in space, and it's got sound, and, you know, grab some elements from Star Wars and everything else. I mean, it was really, and of course, not so much Star Wars, but I guess Battlestar Galactica with the ships looking like the Cylons and whatnot. So What a great selling point if you're gonna kind of, you know, say, well, this is, let's deciding between machines, let's maybe choose this one. So
yeah, I suspect that game sold a lot of Atari computers back in those days. Yep. Because that was definitely one of the best games out there on any platform.
And it, I don't know, I guess that was developed internally by Atari, and it shows because whatever, I guess in today's day and age, we'd say that was maybe, would be like the Apple equivalent of private frameworks, or certainly machine language, or you know, things that the people who were really close to it knew how to do, which... something that's come to light, which I really had no idea about until hearing it on Antic, was how protective Atari was of these kind of development documents, and how it really was, you know, kind of the 82, 83 before these things got disseminated. So for that to be so well done, but in a somewhat, so I guess internally developed by Atari is... It really showed, and for somebody to go ahead and replicate that would have been pretty difficult. So yeah, it was definitely left an impression, and we played a quite. My one was Milkman, that was a little bit later, and I knew I was first exposed to the Atari 800 version of Milkman. I wasn't even aware that it existed in a slightly different form in like a coin op type deal, but there's actually a funny story about that. The in the research and development department at the university, you know, they had they used Atari 800s, and on lunch breaks and a lot of times like after hours, after classes were done or after people should have been going home, they would play Missile Command. And there was one lady in the office who's a professor who was so good at it, she got to like level 60 something. I mean, there were, if you remember, there were color combinations, and you know, you'd get through level 2 or level 3, it would turn blue. I'm not 100% certain of this, but you know, the background would shift. And I remember walking in and seeing a color combination. It was like almost like a pink and maybe a brown or some odd like peep poke combination, going, what on earth is this? How far is this person gone? And the things were going across the screen so fast, I just couldn't believe it. So there was a little bit of a Missile Command revolution at the in R&D at the university. So yeah, certainly they used it for productivity, but everybody really seemed to like playing the games too, to the point where, you know, they would sneak a few minutes at lunch or whatever to do that. So that was, you know, that left an impression too, to think that, you know, it's not only kids who can play these games. So that was definitely kind of a fun thing.
Did you guys have any of the peripherals? Did you have the disk drive or, you know, printers or a modem or anything like that with it as well?
Yeah, you know, we did. The 400, we just had the, starting out, we just had the cassette, the 410. Mm-hmm. And the 400, I'm trying to think here. Yeah, we had the cassette, and that was kind of the primary storage at that time. We didn't have a disk. I don't believe we got a disk drive until, and maybe we had it for the tail end of the 400, but certainly we got an 800 not too long after that, basically replaced the 400 with the 800, and then we had a couple 810s, and kind of slowly as the university started to acquire things, we were able to kind of have a similar setup at home. So we had yeah, so the 400, though, we did do a couple of modifications on it, and this is something I remember as far as, you know, first time I kind of stuck my head in, you know, kind of, and saw what was underneath all the RF shielding and everything. We, my dad and I modified the keyboard. We put the, it wasn't the full travel keyboard, but it was like a dark brown, and it was pretty good. It was real similar to the XE keyboard. The keys had about that much travel, made a world of difference. And then we also put additional RAM in there while the keyboard was off, because it was a fairly large ordeal. I had to take the thing all the way off and unscrew everything. So when we had the, I remember my dad saying, well, we've got everything out here. There are a few empty, you know, RAM slots there. Let's go ahead and up the memory. And we must have upped it to, if it had 16, we must have upped it to 20. Oh, no, we upped it to 32. 32. 32? But yeah. And I remember that was verified with a ingenious peek or poke statement. I can't remember which one, but you could There were actually a couple of different ways to do it, but the one that we had was, you know, you just type the statement in BASIC, and it would, you know, spit out a value, and the value was the number in bytes of RAM. So you'd see 32, 768, or 767. And we said, wow, that's great, you know, huge accomplishment, gold star for both of us. So
that actually... You guys had a tricked out 400, it sounds like.
We did. I didn't realize how kind of lucky we were, but we did. And that carried us through. I honestly don't know if we still have that machine. It actually might still be at my dad's. And if it is, I'll have to take a picture or maybe see if it still works and send it to you guys. But yeah, so from there, like I said, I think at the tail end of the 400, we got an 810. And really, though, we got the bulk of the peripherals when we got the 800.
So you never really, you had the 400 and you had an 800. You never really got into the XL or XE line?
You know, it's a funny thing. I should probably kind of get into how and why we were able to have this. I mentioned the relationship between Atari and my dad's employer a little bit, but it really extended into a couple of things. So, the Provost Moyet was able to get Atari to donate some computers, and those were actually for the purpose of hosting an Atari computer camp. In researching this more since the last time we've talked, I found that there were a couple of different versions of these. There's a full-blown Atari computer camp, I think actually called Camp Atari, which was a very, very involved, like highly scheduled, you know, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. activities like tennis and, you know, lunches and barbecues and everything. And this camp was not that. It was not the, almost like a country club version, you know, day camp with, kind of live-in, you know, food and all that. This was not that. It's Urban University and, very much just kind of extracurricular stuff except for the camp activities. But it was quite successful. My dad was put in charge of overseeing the kids and kind of teaching the camp. And it was aimed at fifth, sixth, and seventh graders, right around there. So certainly kids a lot older than I was. But the great thing about this was Atari wanted to, or the university, since you know, they had this relationship with the gentleman who had the relative at Atari. They wanted to incorporate microcomputers into their university structure, and in fact, they did. The College of Education, Research Development Department, and some of the other ones, the Business School, and a few others, for a period of time, used Ataris for what college professors and departments use them for today, and very successfully. Atari Writer, VisiCalc, some database software, all of the, you know, kind of go-to applications were used heavily, and that was a big success. And I, again, in kind of looking back, just thought that was pretty normal. And whether it was Atari or Apple or IBM, at that time in the early 80s, I found that this was actually not all that normal. You might have some kind of odd, swap of mainframes and terminals and, you know, decks and PDPs and, you know, some sort of, odd combination of those. But to actually have, I don't know if you want to say like consumer level or just regular home computers in the college system or university system was somewhat rare. Mm-hmm. But because they had, you know, they had seen how well these computers worked in the camp setting, it was kind of a no-brainer for them to say, all right, well, we want to incorporate these into our offices. And the people that used them were sorry to see them go. I can't remember exactly when they kind of transitioned and started the move to kind of, I think we had a few years of Apple, and then from there eventually went to IBM PC, and you know, who knows what it is now. But the fact that the in my dad's responsibilities with the camp, you had lesson plans and they worked on programs, and one of the things that the university came to him and said, all right, well, and Atari as well said, you know, you have children at home, you know, we want you to have the same peripherals and the same computer system that we're using in the camp, you know, you can try this out. You can see, are there things that work, are there things that don't work? And like in the case of the 400, that was a pretty easy one. So I, you know, the 400s that were in there in the very beginning had the membrane keyboard. They were quickly switched out, and I think then just, you know, pretty much replaced by the 800. And that was the kind of go-to machine. Now, the interesting thing about this is, even though, as Ataris were becoming more popular in the university, we did see just about all the models that we had, except for the 1450. So we actually did have, I want to say, an 800XL and a 130XE and the 800. And I can't remember exactly why or what happened, but the big thing about the XL was the, you know, you had to use the translator disk. And that right there, just that built-in little step was a reason kind of not to use it. And then the XE came pretty late in the game. I want to say we maybe got the XE at home. It had to be probably 84, 85. And just really, we were running kind of legacy stuff on it. We ran all the stuff we would run on the 800. So I'm sure there were applications or things that would have allowed us to use the extra memory, but we just never did it. And it's something I'd certainly like to revisit, but it's funny, even though we had those machines that were much more capable, the 800 was what we went back to, and that's the one that is actually still sitting on the ping pong table at my folks' house. We got it back out a year or so ago, and I've been on this hunt to try to find some programs that both my dad and I wrote, and I haven't found them yet. I kind of have to.
Oh, you haven't?
Oh, no,
What kind of programs did you write?
Oh, we wrote all sorts. There were some projects that kind of transferred over from the camp setting, but there's a great, I actually looked up and loaded it. It's available in the public domain. There's a great, almost like a choose your own adventure one called Volcano, and I didn't realize it's actually was a commercial product back in the day. I think we got it on a BBS, but we had no idea it was. Yeah, I don't know how public domain it was, but anyway, it would give this. It was patterned after Mount St. Helens, 1981, and you had these choices you could make. And if you didn't make the kind of right survivalist choice, get to higher ground, et cetera, you'd see this, you know, this animation of this volcano. And then I think you got about three tries, and if you got a third answer wrong, you'd see this eruption and be treated as some really morbid. You know, this many people were killed, and you know. Because they didn't go to higher ground, or because they tried to outrun the lava, or you know, something like that. So this was kind of fascinating, and my dad said, you know, I can write a program like that, but let's use something else. Let's use a tsunami. So I remember he said, okay, he found a way to kind of to code up a wave that came in, and he got it, and it would kind of crest, and then he couldn't get the part where it would actually break over and kind of envelop the screen quite right, but he used the same template that this volcano adventure used. So we had things like that. A lot of times we'd grab a 10 or 20 line thing from compute or something and use that to find a color or find a sound. I actually mentioned to the Rob over at Player Missile that he talked quite a bit about sound on the Atari. And we had this great program, and it turns out it came from Atari Connection, called Sound Finder. And all it was plug the joystick in and move the joystick around the screen, and as it animated just a little pixel, and as you moved it around, you'd get a somewhat random, value, the four voice values, and you could just stop on something. So it was just a great way, if you wanted like a ship or an airplane or some really oddball sound, you'd move around the screen. It didn't take much. I mean, the screen was, I don't know, 160 by 120 or whatever. It wasn't one of these super high-res graphic modes. It's probably graphics 3 or graphics 4. And I mean, we used that. That's how we found our kind of odd sounds to use. So most of what Dad did was in BASIC. I delved into, some stuff in Action and Assembler, and it was just a little bit beyond me, but I did really enjoy it, and kind of very, very late in the game, I did dig in, and I made a scrolling Starfield in assembly that, boy, do I wish I could find that. So really, it's just for nostalgia. I know we spent hours and hours, you know, we had a few big projects. I actually made a BBS simulator of all things that would mimic, you know, dialing in and choosing things. I'm like, I look back at that now and go, it's pretty silly, but I'd still love to find it. And, you know, just some other creations. You know, there were some half-baked projects in there where, you know, this was going to be, you know, something to make, you know, our own kind of graphics files that would store the bytes in a different way and make them retrievable and load faster. So, you know, it was kind of all sorts of things, but that was, you know, my introduction to programming, and as kind of something that was really fun, was something I really enjoyed. You know, the other thing is, we do a lot in Pilot, and, you know, I found, yeah, the camp actually worked a lot in Logo, Atari Logo, with, you know, Turtle Graphics and everything. Mm-hmm. That was what the kids were introduced to first, which was great. But, you know, in looking back, it's hard to find stuff on Pilot. I really, really enjoyed that. I know it had a limited color palette. And if you look at Pilot programs, they actually look a little bit like Pascal, where it's modular, you don't have line numbers, or it's just very different from BASIC. But we were able to do some great things in Pilot. So that was another one, in addition to BASIC, that I felt was... you know, was something that we both knew pretty well. And
I don't know a lot about Pilot. That's one language I've never really you know, done much research on. So it sounds like it was a good learning language.
Yeah, I certainly didn't know this when I was using it as a young guy, but it was designed to be, I guess, kind of a bridge between Logo and BASIC, where you had you know, you could do a little bit more, but it wasn't the I guess intimidating notion of line numbers and subroutines and everything else. So but I mean looking back and some of the programs we did, or you know, just a couple of things on YouTube or whatever, it did have quite a bit of power in there. I just don't think it ever really caught on. The sense that I get is that it didn't, you know, Atari had something in mind for it and it never really lived up to that, or maybe it just didn't sell well. It was probably outrageously expensive. That was something that we were really insulated for. I mean, we, you know, we had a fairly middle class upbringing, and if not for the university kind of situation, we would have maybe had one, you know, an Atari 400, and that was it for years, and then maybe an 800. But certainly, we wouldn't have had the printer. We definitely had an 850 interface box. I had no idea that they were A, expensive, or B, even I thought they came with the. That was just having an Xbox, so kind of interesting that you guys talked about that and how expensive it was. And my dad's reaction would have been the same. No way am I going to pay $200 for something that we can plug into the joystick port. So, man, oh man, that would have been. I can hear him saying, as a matter of fact. So, anyway, but I was, you know, clearly insulated from that. And we had we had an 825. We printed stuff all the time, and you know, I certainly understand how fortunate we were to be able to use that. And then we had a few, we didn't have too many exotic things, but we did have a Koala drawing tablet. That was really neat.
I remember those. I had one of those back in the day too.
And I'm trying to think if that was pretty much it. You know, it's funny, I always wanted an Atari ST, and we could never really justify it. We never got one. I remember seeing them at computer shows, and you know, but that was kind of the next logical step, and we kind of pivoted and got an Apple IIgs a couple of years after the SD came out, and that was, you know, our own machine, and it was kind of separate from the university thing. So that was kind of that, but, you know, the ST had such a rich, you know, MIDI and, you know, peripherals and all that. And I was really, really, really wanted one, but that was kind of, yeah, it was, like I said, when it went a different direction, but... peripherals, you know, certainly we had a modem, or a couple of modems as well. We had the one that didn't use the interface box, and the one that did, and that was great. But I think that's about it as far as that goes.
So, Chris, you mentioned the Atari summer camps. I was hoping we could delve into that just a little bit more.
Sure.
I know you were very young, and you may not have a lot of memories, or maybe you didn't go all the time with your dad to these. I don't know, but you're. Has your dad talked about these a lot? Is there anything more you can tell us about the Atari camps and what they were like and what they did there?
Yeah, I'll try to give you as much information as I can, or as both of us remember. There was a pretty defined template for for the first session. It came from Atari, and we're pretty sure it came from their Camp Atari template. But really, it allowed the instructor a fair amount of leeway. It suggested topics to cover, and in certainly starting in Logo, that was turtle graphics and just basic typing skills and that sort of thing. And one of the great things about Logo, at least Atari Logo, was you had the I'm so rusty on my graphics modes, but you had the text input. It was in a small a small kind of bar on the bottom of the screen, and then you type the command to show the turtle, but you could keep, it was like in today's it would be like a console or like a debug console on the Mac or something like that, but it was only a couple lines of text, so you had most of the screen to work with, but you could kind of keep a running kind of tally of what was going on in one of the modes for Logo. So just getting the turtle on the screen and animating that turtle and then having the turtle draw, that was, I think that was pretty much the, getting everybody on the same page of that was kind of the first thing to do. And then it kind of went from there I'm pretty sure that the beginner's camp stayed in Logo, might have gone, branched out into Pilot a little bit, but there were more advanced ones where they started to get into Basic, and it was... kind of from one of the ones I remember actually that he brought home that grew into a much larger program was this program that did arithmetic, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and would kind of quiz the students on whether it was multiplication tables or the things that were appropriate for fifth, sixth, and seventh grade. And I remember when we got it home, we modified it a little bit to where it would play a little like four chord thing if you got a couple answers in a row right, and if you got several in a row wrong, it would basically give you this kind of awful tone and get worse and worse and so on and so forth. So that was using animating the turtles and turtle graphics, and then getting into the kind of the Logo had some sprite stuff that could be done too, I guess, player missile stuff for in Atari speak, and that was that. It was, the kids really enjoyed it. It was a relatively small group, I want to say 8 to 10 kids. And I think we had some sort of a projector set up to where, the dad's computer would kind of display in, some sort of a, like an opaque projector or something like that. And then it was a small enough room, or, it was a small enough class to where he could go, to help folks out if they needed it. I did tag along a few times, not very often. The interesting story there is they also did an adult camp to where, whether it was teachers or faculty or some folks in the university would have a need to either teach something in the Atari realm or just to use it. And they covered a lot of the same things. This is, for people who were not, maybe had no experience with this, or maybe it was from used a different machine or different platform. And that I actually did sit in on quite a bit, because I was kind of quietly typing away. So that I would have been, certainly a little bit older by this point. But I remember I created a program all on my own of the 45 minutes of them stepping through turtle stuff, and I had this big program at the end, and he said, "Oh, I'm going to show this to the class," and it was kind of an embarrassing thing, but I created this race car deal where, the lines going by and everything, so I do remember that, so I certainly was able to tag along for the adult version of the camp, which was just kind of a pared down, more like an intro. That I think our community college has an intro to the Macintosh, intro to the such and such. So that was so they did that, and that was at night, and maybe once a week or whatnot. But the officially sanctioned Atari stuff was for the kids. I'm trying to remember any other kind of important details about that. It went on for several years. I don't know exactly why it stopped. I think the ceasing of the camp kind of mirrored the, declining popularity of the 8-bit machine, or
sure,
at the very least the Atari, and that would have had to, and certainly Atari came out with the ST as well. That seemed to take a little bit of the focus away, but I want to say it continued at least through 1985, 86. I think by 86, things were kind of winding down. I think the switch to out of Atari to some kind of odd, Apple hybrid, as far as the labs and everything went, happened in 87. So that would have been a right. So it went on for several years and was well attended. And like I said, certainly not the, tennis and breakfast at 8 a.m. and then programming type thing that I saw a couple ads or, a few references in magazines. It wasn't that, but for what it was, it was a good thing, and certainly, I guess in a selfish way, allowed us to be able to use and kind of become familiar with the Atari equipment at home, and then really, worked in lockstep with allowing the university at large to incorporate Ataris into their kind of daily routine.
Okay. So what do you own today? Do you own any Ataris today? And I'm sure you do.
It's when the switch was kind of made, it's funny, the university didn't want to hang on to a lot of this stuff. They had no room for it. They had, mainframe parts and all this, since I guess this is somewhat common at maybe not every university, but they had a kind of a glut of equipment, and a lot of it just got donated out or ended up at Goodwill. But luckily Dad was able to say, there's probably some historical value here. Let's see if we can hang on to one of each kind of iteration or one of each machine. So so personally, I don't actually own any of it, but my folks live 20-30 minutes from where I live, so we see them quite a bit. So you can call it joint ownership, perhaps. But I've got to check on the 400, but we definitely still have the 800. We still have a 130XE. We have a couple of 810s. I don't know how well they work. One of them is a happy drive. The 810 had a happy conversion, I believe. Mm-hmm. The main disk drive that we use to try to read those 35-year-old floppies is, I think we have a couple of 1050s. We do have the 410, but it hasn't been used in, over 30 years. It probably is of extreme value to somebody for parts, but I don't even know if it would spin up.
Probably not.
And the stuff that I mentioned before, I want to say we got an Epson, an old Epson, to work with the Atari at some point, but the 825's in there, the interface box. We're very interested to hear about the black interface box. Ours was not that. That definitely would have been a cool thing, but ours are just the standard beige. And then we have joysticks and paddles, and I did not see the Koala tablet. I think that was the university owned that one, and that did go back and got redistributed somewhere, I'm pretty sure. So we do have most of the old stuff, even if it's just one of each. And the 800, I mean, it has been rock solid from the day we got it. We haven't had any trouble with it. Nothing has, I mean, it's really amazing for as much as that machine got used. Even into the mid-90s, I remember right before I went to college, when Brad Arnold mentioned the split screen games, I had one that I played even that I would have been 17 years old, and my friend and I would still play. It was called Trailblazer. It was like Ball Blazer, but you'd have a split screen view of a soccer ball in space, kind of going through and try to go as fast as you could through this thing. And we played that even years after it was anybody it was certainly available in stores or anything like that. So that 800 got heavy use, certainly in the mid to, kind of late 80s, and then on and off really throughout the years after that. And it is just, I know it's going to fail one of these days, but it's something I expect to just turn on and work. It's such a workhorse that, you know, and we still have a TV, we still have an RF modulator to hook up to it. We did have an old Texas Instruments CRT monitor that we used instead of the TV. I understand why now, you know, less artifacting and colors and whatnot. And that was, I understand, an extravagance. That was, again, thanks to the university. So certainly wouldn't have had a standalone dedicated monitor in those days, at least for us. But it still works. It's a reason to keep this 12-inch, you know, ancient color TV, you know, plugged in or at least handy.
Right. Yeah, I've got one of those.
Yeah.
That's about all they're good for these days.
Right. Pretty much.
They work well with these old computers. So.
And I seem to remember we used to hook it up to a black and white TV too. We had one of those that was the same size, and that seems a little bit insane. But in a pinch for downloading a file on a BBS or something, I think we did that as well. So as far as kind of ownership goes, the university said, I mean, they wouldn't even know what to, you know, what we were talking about if we tried to give this stuff back these days. And they said, no, okay, go ahead and just hang on to it. We don't, it's, you know, we're not going to not gonna resell it or anything like that. So
does your dad ever use any of this equipment that is at his house, or does he not have any interest in it anymore?
I wouldn't say that he doesn't have any interest, but he has kind of the space it occupies in the basement. There are a couple other things that he does. He builds a lot of things, so he wouldn't be too likely to sit down and say, oh, I'm gonna load up Canyon Climber, or I'm gonna, you know, see if I can, you know, figure something out. But certainly when the university was, when he was involved in the camp, and then later on when he was a dean for quite a while, I mean, he would use it at home quite a bit. So there was a time where, you know, it was really for his work, and then, you know, for games and stuff too. But he wouldn't be too apt to boot it up on his own. I'm trying to get him to see, hey, you know, can you go through like a couple discs and just mark them down? I mean, the labeling system, I just, you know, both of our handwriting is horrible, and you know, half the time there's a label on there and it doesn't correspond to what it is. I know this is, you know, somewhere the folks at archive.org are rolling over going, God, archive that stuff. So I know I'm trying to, but I will be very, very happy if I happen upon even a few of these programs. I'm convinced they're in there. And honestly, the floppies read at a pretty remarkable rate. I mean, it was certainly, I remember even the floppies being unreliable. You know, they'd come out of the box or, you know, a couple of days or weeks, and they'd give you the, you know, error 144 or whatnot. So it's really amazing how many of them read, but it is a bummer. You know, I'd say probably 3 out of 10 just will not read at all.
You need to get an SIO to SD or something like that.
Yeah, that's
this stuff transferred over.
I think that's going to be on the Christmas list. You know, there's so many good options. Even since, like, I remember listening to the first episode of Antics, it seems like so much progress. There's so many additional options are available that there's really no excuse. So I think I'm going to definitely do that and at least get a way to grab what we have and kind of go from there. So when I go to visit, we'll both sit down and go through a couple of discs. So it's something we kind of do together, kind of like we did many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And we kind of do that. And then, you know, every while I'll be, oh, hey, you remember this, you know, Parachute Jumper or something. We'll say, oh, let's play this for a little bit. So, but he's not very likely to do it on his own.
Sure. So did you use bulletin boards at all?
Yeah.
You said you had a couple of modems. Did you peruse the bulletin boards, or were you too young for that?
No, it's interesting. I was certainly too young to really understand kind of what I was getting into, but no, we did. So it's so interesting when I look back at the at BBSs. For me personally, they're kind of in three distinct time frames. So it was the, you know, the 8-bit days of, you know, early stuff, you know, from, you know, Ward Christensen and X Modem on, to where, you know, for me it was just about 100% Atari boards, so boards that ran Amos or I can't remember what the other competing one was. So there was that, and then from there there was just a little bit of Apple II stuff, didn't get into that too much, and then kind of picked back up once the, you know, MS-DOS PC era, and called a lot of bulletin boards there until, you know, really that takes us all the way up to when they started to go away at such a rapid rate. But to be honest, the kind of best memories I have are of those early kind of Atari BBS days. And you know, certainly there, I look back now, and there was some gritty kind of stuff that certainly you wouldn't want kids to see. I never encountered that. I certainly didn't even know enough to really look for it, but I was maybe insulated or young enough to where that was never really kind of an issue, which was good, quite frankly. But where we started was two boards that I remember. CLOG, which was the Chicagoland Atari Users Group. CLOG was CLOG, and then they had a CLOG 2, which I think was just because the regular board was so busy. I can still remember the phone number to the first one, 889-1240. Area code 312 was all 312 back then.
That's amazing. But you remember that.
You know, to talk about a peek into my goofy brain here. But yeah, I cannot remember important things, but I can remember that. So, you know.
Right.
But actually, the first first computer we dialed up was the university mainframe. And it was somewhat incompatible, but it worked enough where we were able to see the menu screen that it was kind of a, for us, like a proof of concept thing, and that would have been with the MPP 1000C modem, the blue one, that plugged into the joystick port, and whatever the, I think it was a cartridge, was it SmartTerm or something like that came with it, and boy, that was mind-blowing when we were able to do that. And, you know, I mentioned this, I wrote just a kind of a brief thing on one of the textiles.com as a little synopsis of kind of some of my memories about this, but I'll mention it here too. The login and the password for my dad to get into his, I guess like his faculty account, it was his full social security number, and that's what was used. And I just think, man, in 1981 or whatever year it was around there, and who else had the capability to dial in? I mean, there was very little risk of somebody, you know, coming in. But I think nowadays that would just be, you know, alarm bells, you know, off the wazoo,
right,
something like that. But how crazy was that? That was the, you know, that was the way to, you know, so it was password protected, but it was, by golly, it was his social security number. It's kind of absolutely ridiculous nowadays. But, and that was actually a Harris mainframe, and, you know, it there were some garbled characters. It really didn't like a ASCII, and you know, there was some loss in translation, but good enough to, you know, just think of the scene from War Games where he goes in and changes his grades. That was kind of the display that I remember. It was very similar to that, but but more of just a, hey, we can do this. And then I believe it was actually stored on the mainframe. There was a BBS list, and that's how we got the number to CLOG. And then the other one, which I think he's been on the show there, was the Suburban Chicago Atarians one, SCAT BBS. Yeah. They had actually, both of those BBSs were really fantastic. A lot of software, a lot of very active user group message boards, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a really, really great resource. I didn't obviously participate in any of the message board or forum stuff, but we were able to upload and download. We uploaded the programs that we created. We downloaded programs that other people had done, utilities and so on and so forth. So it was a really, it was really quite good. That was a really fantastic thing. And to think of how amazing it is that those machines ran, a lot of times it was, you know, just whether the machines were left on all day or all night, you know, one, the capacity of your, you know, your memory and disk drive, it, I just can't believe for as much traffic as both of those BBSs received, that the disk drives didn't just burn out. I can't believe how, with how little they had, how really reliably those were able to run. And that was fantastic. I learned, this was when I was a little bit older, but I learned a very hard lesson about phone bills and A-band, B-band, C-band, D-band, and got a very, very keen appreciation for how far away things were and how Antioch, Illinois is nowhere near Chicago, Illinois, or where I was calling from. As a matter of fact, it might as well be Wisconsin, and was billed as such. So,
wow.
like many people who are maybe a year or two older than me who had this with CompuServe. I never did CompuServe, but boy, did I get it in spades with phone bills. It was really bad news.
Some stories there.
Yeah, that was, that facilitated the map and the drawing of the circle, getting out the compass and saying, here's 8 miles, 0 to 8 miles was the one that was, and then of course you could call late at night, but yeah, I went to school and, I didn't stay up all night or anything like that. So yeah, that was, and in fact, it was Illinois Bell and Call Packs. That was the name of the plan that, did not really, agree with, people, calling bulletin boards, but really had a great experience, really kind of informed, a lot of the kind of how I kind of encountered BBSs later on. And, it was really great. I, feel very fortunate to have been a part of it at that kind of early time. A lot of people don't even realize that BBSs were around in the 8-bit days, or if they do, they, maybe it was Commodores and everything else, but really every system at that time had bulletin boards, and man, were they incompatible with the Atari. The Ataski was great, but I remember trying to dial a few, color computer or Cocoa boards or a Mac board. It was just, complete. It couldn't even decipher anything. So the last story I'll tell about BBS is I remember back to the MPP modem, you had two options as far as downloading goes. You could save it in system memory, which was good for a smaller file, or the workaround to not being limited to 48K or 64K or whatever we had. For us, it was 48K, was it had a direct-to-disk option, which would just save sector by sector. So this enabled you to get a full game, or, if we happen to stumble upon maybe a non-public domain site here and there, which I can absolutely tell you that we did, touchdown football or something, which would take hours and hours, but call late at night and just let it go. Let it, turn it on, dial it up at midnight and let it go till 3 a.m, somebody wake up and turn it off. Well, this seems like a great idea. With an 810, though, we had the unfortunate experience that I think several other people did as well. So it would, I remember you could actually watch the sectors come in at 300 baud, and occasionally you'd catch something you recognize, like a name, or it actually displayed the characters, which was kind of wild, and this plotting 300 baud, and then sector 1, sector 2, etc., etc. So save it direct to disk, and it would either get the disk drive noise or the system noise. Well, after about 150 sectors of this, the 810 got way too hot, overheated, and actually a capacitor let go and started smoking. So I remember shutting everything off, pulling all the cables out, and I just grabbed the thing and put it outside, and that we had our basement open up to a little well and some stairs. I took it out there, and that 810 was completely toast. So the direct-to-disk option was not considered until we got a 1050, which was not too long after that, but it would read too many read writes that eventually fried it, and couldn't quite do it. So that for that brief time, we were then limited to what we could do in system memory, but it worked just fine with the 1050, and that was how we were able to do those larger downloads, which we did, and it was pretty great.
Okay, Chris, anything you want to close with here? That anything else you want to bring up, or that you recall that you'd like to share before we close?
Sure. I just want to just mention a quick bit about maybe an application or two, and one of them was an APX application called I believe it was Advanced Music Studio, and the file extension was AMS. Uh-huh. I don't know if are you familiar with that one?
No, I think I've heard of it, but I don't think I had ever used it.
I think it was in one of the other podcasts where they talked about, it was the Analog interview where they talked about actually being able to write Atari music and give, a note and a, F sharp and a duration and, et cetera, et cetera, all the way up to 32nd or 64th notes. And this Advanced Music Studio, I want to say, The person who wrote it, his first name was Lee. I don't want to give a wrong last name, but we actually had the Apex disc. It was a true, you know, straight from APX with the envelope and everything and manual. And this program was just phenomenal. You would go through in a fairly tedious way, and you could enter, you know, the note and the musical values and everything. And then the great thing was it would play it in the best Atari, you know, pokey chip synthesis of a piano, but it would actually show it to you on screen. So you'd have your, you know, it was a white background, and you'd get each voice would animate on the actual piano key in a different color. So voice 1, 2, 3, and 4 would be, I can't remember what the colors were, but say it'd be like green, pink, yellow, and blue. And then of course you would go up to the, so you'd actually see, it was like a player piano or a piano roll going by where it would show you what was done. And I mean, it was just really amazing. I remember we're a big musical family, so Dad plays piano, and I did a little bit, and we were able to pull out some sheet music, and we were actually able to enter some music, and it was amazing. We did, what do you do, of all things, right? For some reason, theme to The Young and the Restless, one of the easy songs I could play, we did that. We did a song called Major Tom, so not Space Oddity, but the Peter Schilling version of Major Tom, and I actually played in a piano recital. We did that, and that was really great. And then, of course, there was a, you know, a relatively devoted community of people who would create these things on their own, and that was, you'd find, you know, file downloads and whatnot of these AMS files. And I think, you know, somebody wrote a front end or a player where you didn't have to have this big, complicated advanced music studio to play it. You could just get the file and play it, which was good. But a really, really, probably kind of far ahead of its time program that we played Christmas carols on it 1 year. It was really, really fantastic. I just kind of wanted to mention that. That was kind of a crossover into music, which definitely a lot of good memories there. And then the other thing, maybe, and I've kind of touched on it, that I, when I think about the things that I really enjoyed or appreciated, or things that when I approach the little bit of development that I do or working with computers today, is this notion of constraints and how much I appreciate how amazing these accomplishments were in 4K or 8K, or in the case of the 2600, even less than that. How you know, these programs, whether it was user-created programs or companies or Atari itself, really create these really, really just amazing pieces of software. And it owes a lot of that to the hardware, and certainly the machine wars of, you know, Commodore's better, Atari's better, Apple's better, you know, all use the 6502, they all have, can, you know, lay claim to a certain thing that they do really well. But was a sense as a kid that there was no other machine that could do what the Atari did. And with that, it was kind of a little bit of pride there that, you know, we had this, we were able to create our own programs and, you know, play these great games and do all these things. And it was just a really great experience. And I tried to take a little bit of that and encapsulate that into the development that I do, you know, on iOS and for the, you know, iPhone or iPad. And if I'm able to even recapture just a little bit of that, I think it's a, you know, I feel pretty proud of that. But it's just amazing that whether it was, you know, sound graphics or, you know, software library, BBSs, peripherals, it all we seem to work so well. And it's just a real shame that, you know, Atari went kind of a different direction. I was old enough when Tramiel took over to remember that, and I remember thinking, that's a little vain naming the OS for the ST, Tramiel operating system. And that's a little bit of a stretch, but yeah. You know, I read Antic and Analog when I could, but I didn't have a subscription. Kind of crazy that I didn't. I should have just talked about asking for something for Christmas. Why didn't I do that? But occasionally I'd get to the library or somebody at school would have it, but I wasn't a regular enough reader to really be in tune with this kind of opinion of Tramiel. And as far as the Time Warner stuff goes, the stuff I look at now, and very, very interesting, but kind of went mostly over my head. I remember certainly seeing the Time Warner symbol on the cartridge or whatnot, but so I didn't really, I didn't have this kind of negative view of Tramiel that seems to kind of permeate kind of the direction of Atari in the later years. And I just thought, he's got the ST, he's gonna, you know, he's gonna go on and take over and do great things. And when I, you know, first encountered the very first Apple II, and, you know, kind of so on and so forth, I was, and we had Apple IIs in our elementary school, I was a little angry. I said, you know, this is, I'm looking at, you know, four colors and, you know, kind of unresponsive screen, and, you know, I'm like, this is what is being kind of sold as, you know, whether it was Lemonade Stand or whatever. And these great programs, Apple II programs, Choplifter, and so on and so forth, not saying anything bad about them, but from just a color and presentation standpoint, I felt like I saw this when I was even younger. I mean, Star Raiders had this kind of blown out of the water. So,
sure.
So with the appreciation for working within constraints and kind of blowing those constraints away, whether it was something like Star Raiders or, you know, running a BBS on your machine or anything like that, there was also a little bit of resentment that I felt like the best product didn't win out. So, you know, that kind of informed how I, you know, whether it was Windows or OS2 or different platforms or different things, that the best machine can always win. And by win, I just mean live on. Certainly there was, you know, the Commodore pretty much obliterated everything, and but there felt like, you know, certainly the Apple II and the Commodore went on to be very, very successful. And I didn't quite know how to really articulate it, but it kind of bugged me, especially as I got a little bit older, that here was this machine with all this potential that had been realized, but that didn't get carried on as maybe it should have. And was that Trivial's fault? Yeah, probably some of it was, but I could never quite really kind of come to terms with that. So it was just such good memories, but kind of maybe what could have been. And, but the great thing is that 800 still works. You know, I can
that's
still
right.
Work
you up. You can still play it today and enjoy it, and that's the nice thing about it is they were built like tanks. They still work today. It's amazing. Yeah.
And then as far as the, you know, being able to just record the little segment, you know, the you know, running it on the iPad for iOS, I just think that's a little bit of a hook that I can, you know, I always got a really big kick out of, you know, doing things on devices that people said, oh, you can't run Windows on that, or you can't do it. Well, you know, I might not be able to run it well, but maybe I can, or maybe it's good enough for solitaire or something. So I kind of feel like that gives me a little bit of a window back to, if it's not on the original hardware, I can still, you know, I was able to type in the Sound Finder program on the iPad with the external keyboard and run it. And the sound is pretty, you know, as sound in emulation is a huge challenge. And then two levels deep, it does actually give you the great, I think it's Hail Britannia, but it sounds like somebody is strangling the Prokey chip. So you get the voice, and, you know, it... if you don't, it's a little bit slow and everything, but you know, it's there. But at least right now, you know, emulation on a mobile device, sound is a luxury that at least the way I had it set up, it can't quite do. But the rest of it actually works pretty well. So yeah. I'm happy to be able to do that.
Yeah, we're really appreciative that you provided that segment for the show.
Oh, sure,
that
thing.
Was great.
Happy to do so.
So, Chris, thank you very much for your time. We really, really appreciate it. Some great stories, some great memories. I think everybody's going to enjoy hearing that. So I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us. And, you know, maybe we'll have you on the show another day with something else. I know you're pretty active, so it's great to have you out there as a fan of the show and just someone to talk Atari with once in a while.
Well, I really appreciate it. I look forward to all the various podcasts, but especially Antic, you know, each and every month. And I feel like I'm sharing this space with Rare Air. I mean, the folks that you guys have had on and that the other shows have had, I don't really feel quite worthy to be, you know, next to the ranks of Mike Alba or Jim Caparel, but I definitely love talking about this, and I will continue to do so until somebody says we are just, you've talked too much. So let's, but I appreciate the chance to be on, and I really appreciate it. Look forward to the show each and every time, and hope to hear many, many more.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris.
All right. Thanks.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Of course, they're both going to be Atari kids, right? And they're going to
absolutely, definitely. I was going to say,